This is an Epiphany Process interview, sharing people's inspiring insights and life-defining experiences.
Janessa, I have introduced you as a London-based consultant. I want you to share your own experience of loss and tragedy and how that fits into the work you're currently engaged in.
Yeah, I'm a mother of four, and in 2005, after an enormous argument, my daughter Jennifer, who was 16 at the time, I was applying tough love and saying to her she was breaking all the safekeeping house rules. Mm-hmm. And I had to firmly say it has to stop, and she stormed out to leave home. She'd just turned 16 2 weeks before. And I sensed something wasn't right, and I went to check up on her in her room, and when I walked into the bathroom, I found her hanging with a broken neck, absolutely stone dead. So it was a huge thing to have to deal with. The impact of that goes on, and quite frankly, I just didn't know how I would actually move on in the end. It was just so overwhelming. Everything was lost and went down to ground zero, my whole life. And it was only at about, it was the ninth month that, in desperation, having really been very close to ending my life, I came across the basics of a process that I now use with people internationally, online and face-to-face, which really powerfully and authentically provides coping tools for people who are dealing with depression and suicidal thoughts.
We'll talk about that in a moment. I was just about to ask whether, looking back in retrospect, there are telltale signs in your daughter that you missed leading up to her suicide, but you said that you just felt something was not right.
Well, there is a backstory to that. Uh-huh. It was Jenny's fourth attempt, and she did come to me at the age of 13 and say, I have a really big problem and I don't know how to handle it. And the more she dealt with conventional therapy, the more she went down a rabbit hole as she realized they had no idea what she was feeling or thinking, that all their application was theoretical. And I can remember at 14 her turning to this psychologist and saying, you just asked me that question and I think it might be on page 25 of your textbook. So do you want to hear how I really feel, or do you want me to give you the answer the textbook says I must give you and then I'll be all right?
Wow. At 16, this was her fourth attempt.
It was her fourth attempt.
When was the first attempt?
Well, actually, at the time that she told me, we put her into a rehab and they handled her very, very badly and decided she was in the ward for teenagers. They tried to break her, rather like in the army. They tried to break her because she wouldn't cooperate. So they tried bully tactics with her, which didn't work with Jenny. And then they found her in the grounds of the hospital trying to cut her wrists. She had a noose in the tree and she was swallowing bottles of spirit of camphor. And then they expelled her for bad behavior. And then because of that, she ran away. I lost her for 30 hours in the streets of a very large city. Didn't think I'd see her again. So it really started from very bad management at the get-go, and then she didn't believe anybody could really help her. And she tried desperately each time an episode would rise, but she really battled.
So on that fateful day, you had an argument with her and then you feel something is not right. You go to her room and you find her hanging. Take us through what you feel at that moment.
Wow.
and you know, maybe the blaming yourself that.
Yeah, you know, it's that's such a really deep question and request, because people who've been through this will know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
When you have something traumatic like that happen to you, a myriad of contradictory thoughts and feelings just come in and out. It's like watching a film with different cuts that are contradictory. So part of me was desperately trying to get her back to life. And the other part of me was going, oh, thank goodness, she can't harm herself and she's no longer my responsibility. Mm. Those, by the way, are the basis for guilt grief, because what mother goes, oh, thank God my daughter's dead? It's all those things that create scenarios for people to not be able to move on. And it was just such a mixture. How am I going to cope with this for the rest of my life? How am I going to get my family through this? Oh, thank God. What a relief. Thank you, God. Thank you for taking her. It was 100 billion different conversations all going on at once. And part of it I don't remember, because apparently when the police arrived, Jenny had trashed her room in anger before she killed herself. So it looked like there had been a tussle in there. And apparently when the police said what happened, I beat my hands on our garage wall saying, I did it, I killed her, it was me. And they immediately started opening a police docket because they could see that something had gone on. And fortunately for me, I lived next door to a police commissioner who arrived, and he said, no, I know the history of this, and this is a genuine suicide.
But so they thought it was homicide.
Very complicated. Yeah.
Initially, they thought it was a homicide.
Well, they started, you know, looking around and taping and all sorts of things. And the moment that this amazing man arrived, and he just said, "No, you're barking up the wrong tree. This is mother's trauma coming through, her shock."
But you know what you said is really not strange, because I have interviewed someone previously whose husband committed suicide after 6 attempts. And she shared with us, and she said that, you know, when she got the call that he'd finally, actually she found him, when she walked home and found him, her first reaction was relief.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't have to deal with the scare and, you know, the worrying that, is he going to do it today? I wouldn't have to deal with that anymore.
You know, Julia, this is the other thing, that I work with all types of grief, and actually, everybody who loses a loved one has that conflict. It's maybe not as extreme as a trauma, death and loss, but everybody has that conflict when there's a part of them that's relieved the loved one has passed on, and there's a part of them that just wishes they were never going to leave. And it's that conflict that is the basis of grief, and so many people find difficult to move on from. That conflict really confuses the psyche.
But the trauma of suicide lingers on forever, I'm sure, for the family and friends of the victim. Can you recall some of the lowest moments that you experienced before you picked yourself up?
My lowest moment was 2 years after Jen died, and I was in UK in the early stages of doing this work. And I had got through the first year safely, so I thought, okay, I'm all right. And then I found because it's two anniversaries back to back, her birthday and then 2 weeks later her death date. So it's always a difficult time of year for me, and it will always be till the day I draw my last breath. But yeah, there I was in UK, and my darkest hour, because what happens is people write these unwritten rule books. You know, by 2 years you should be. And they become an authority because they're not actually walking the walk. So there's a lot of isolation and aloneness in that grief, where you just feel nobody would even begin to understand if you were to express the depth of aloneness. And it's almost like serving an emotional prison, life prison sentence. And it was just too much. I started organizing my whole suicide. I just thought, I can't go on like this. It's just too lonely and isolating. And a phone call from my brother in Oxford actually kicked me out of it. I was going, what am I doing? But it was a very defining moment and a very necessary moment for me to understand what this was all about.
So you're dealing with your own grief, and your other children are also dealing with the grief of losing their sister. And, you know, as mothers, perhaps sometimes we feel we need to be there for them and, you know, be strong for everyone. How did you balance that? Because you're also grieving.
Yeah.
And they're grieving too.
Absolutely. You know, all you can do is what you can do step by step. Because if you try and follow other people's rule books, you're not being yourself. So the only way to go forward is you take each step. In fact, breathing was the first thing that I had to learn to do, and I have a breathing technique which works really well. So breathing was the very first thing, so that I could get a balanced amount of oxygen in my body and then be able to move forward and say, okay, now what's the next micro step? Because they're micro steps. And where I could be there for my kids, I really tried to be, and when I couldn't be, I couldn't be. I mean, there were days where I just... some mornings I'd wake up and I'd go, I'm not getting out of bed today. And I was very fortunate. I had a friend who knew my stay in bed day, and she'd come and sit and hold my hand for the whole day.
Wow. Suicide is treated as a taboo even in societies that have made great strides in mental health. How did you deal with the attitudes and stereotypes following your daughter's death?
You know, we weren't here in Kenya. The kids were in school in South Africa, mm-hmm. in KwaZulu-Natal, and it's not quite so much of a taboo down there. Mm-hmm. Having said that, a lot of people still felt very unsafe around us as a family, having had a child that died from suicide. You could very visibly see that. But the outpouring of love was overwhelming at that time. But the thing for me here in Kenya is the fact that suicide is a criminal offense. Mm-hmm. For a person that attempts suicide and doesn't succeed, the outcome for them is horrendous. And it's time to change the conversations and even change the law, in my opinion. And if I can be the catalyst that creates that and the spearhead, then my heart is full.
Speaking of conversations, there's been lots of coverage related to depression, suicide, and other mental issues facing Kenyans. How critical is it for mental health issues to be widely spoken about, especially in a society like ours, where people want to battle with such challenges on their own?
Yeah, there's such stigma and taboo attached to having a family member who is suicidal. And that takes a little time. But I have noticed, even in this last year, there's been a profound shift in conversations here in Kenya. I would like to think that maybe the theatrical production we put on last year assisted with that. It was a not-for-profit production with dance and song and music and voiceover and visuals, and I do believe that helped. But there have been many things that have been happening with the World Forum talking more and more about mental health and depression, and even the Royal Family in UK coming out about their depression. I have noticed a shift here in Kenya, but the big thing is that the more people who step forward and speak from their hearts, it takes a lot of courage. I mean, you can imagine the first time I stepped forward and said, you know, I too considered taking my life, and my daughter killed herself after an argument. It's huge. It takes a lot of courage. But if somebody in that situation can step forward in that courage, it makes it easier for the next one and the next one and the next one. And then new conversations can start.
Now, the other aspect to that story, of course, is that awareness on depression is quite low, and it is still viewed as a social rather than health issue.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And again, the being able to step forward more authentically with more open conversations will shift it into it being managed powerfully, where people can gain really powerful coping skills that really work. And then everybody's conversations become very authentic and wise. I've watched amazing, wise conversations, even within my family, because we've now got these coping skills. I was with them in December, and just sitting watching them round a table where everybody can safely express their truth without it being taken personally. Mm-hmm. So everybody's safe to talk, and it's lovingly received. It might not be agreed with, so everybody agrees to disagree, but they feel safe to express. And I can say, quite honestly, it took the loss of Jenny for us to get that beautiful gift as a family.
We'll talk about the coping skills and mechanisms in a short while. Just before we go for break, a popular sports journalist published the story of his battle with depression last week, and then did a follow-up piece where he said he received feedback from people who say that they could relate to many of the symptoms he talked about in his article. How do we help many more people in Kenya to identify signs of depression and other mental illnesses?
Yeah, there are many, many signs. Obviously, the most obvious ones are lethargy, not wanting to get out of bed, constantly consumed with not wanting to carry on and even planning how to leave the planet, withdrawn, not being able to speak to those they love, or there can be other signs. Jenny was the other sign. She'd put on a bright face and pretend she was okay. So when we started dealing with it, everybody was saying, no, but Jenny's a happy child. No, she isn't actually. And she first tried to strangle herself at the age of 7 here in Kenya, in front of the mirror in our house. But she only told me that at 13. So there are different signs depending on the personality types and the coping skills they've chosen to take on, depending on what they're dealing with. Many, many signs. But the most general one is lethargy. And
someone will ask, someone may be wondering, how does a seven-year-old, you know, suffer from depression?
You know, it's happening more and more, and they're getting younger and younger as well. And by her admission, her earliest memory was she didn't want to be here. Her earliest memory, she felt she didn't fit in with our family. She had run a story that she thought she'd been swapped in the hospital, that she wasn't part of our family, she didn't belong. She was actually our most celebrated child because she was the first girl after two boys. But for somebody in that mindset, they don't hear those things. They hear where their inadequacy is, and it is a very warped conversation.
We'll be talking about an issue directly related to depression, which is dealing with the pain and trauma of loss, and your parents' creative genes seem to have passed on to you because you have channeled the issues of depression and suicide into a theatrical production called Insight. More on that later. Breakfast show here on KBC English Service. My name is Julia Wanjiko. We are delighted to be back on The Big Conversation. And this morning we are talking about coping with grief, trauma and tragedy. And my guest this morning is a lady who turned a personal tragedy into an opportunity to travel the world, offering people lessons on coping with grief and trauma. We are privileged to be speaking to Janet Abari, a London-based mental health and awareness expert, sharing some of her useful teachings and experiences with us on The Big Conversation. Also joining us on The Big Conversation is my colleague Mariam Kaptuya. Good morning, Mariam.
Good morning, Julia.
I see you made it home well after Saturday.
I know, that was a blast.
Welcome to The Conversation.
Big party, big party.
Yeah, big party. I heard. Something really amazing.
It was amazing.
Kaptuya. At Sebastian's, I believe.
Yes, at Sebastian's. Yeah. Kaptuya, you've got a question for Janeta.
Yeah, first off, it's very nice to meet you, Janeta.
Such
you know
a
your father, Charles Warren, the producer and the founder of Equata Records. We're very proud of him. He produced really good records. I've been listening in the car on the way here, and I was like, Helule, Lule, and all these other nice songs. It's just amazing. He was a genius. Your dad was able to do this without computers, no gadgets. How did he do that?
I don't know. And as I mentioned earlier, he didn't even read music, and he couldn't play an instrument either. So I think because he was so marginalized as a child, it actually liberated him to try his hand at anything. And that is what we can all do.
Yeah,
I think he was an example setter.
Absolutely. Janeta, I have a question for you about this topic that we're having today, suicide and alcoholism. I've been interacting with a lot of young people who are dealing with alcoholism. Actually, I don't even know the difference between alcoholism and just drinking a lot in Nairobi today. But most of them tell me that the problem comes from their relationship with their parents. They say their parents don't understand them. Their parents are still treating them as kids, and they're on their way towards 40, and they're threatening to kill themselves. In fact, I have a story of a young man who killed himself recently. So what do I tell these young people?
Well, actually, I think the increase in alcohol consumption is a worldwide happening. It's happening more and more with the youth worldwide, and it's basically because there are a lot of pressures on to be a certain thing and in a certain way. And in my opinion, it stemmed from Western world teachings that came in 1952. I can even give you the year. Post-war, a man some of you might know called Norman Vincent Peale wrote a book called The Power of Positive Thinking. And it was the answer to making your life work after the horrors of the war. And as much as being positive really is very important, so I'm not marginalizing being positive, it's only half of what we are and half the story. So whilst you're trying to be half of who you are, you're trying to reach standards that are not complete and are usually other people's standards and values. So it stops you from being authentic to yourself, and it marginalizes you in having coping skills to lead a balanced life. So what happens is, because you don't know how to deal with yourself internally and fix yourself, you look for an outside fix that makes you feel okay. So alcohol, drugs, sex, it can come in many forms, many, many forms. Food, to fill that half missing, the missing that we haven't been shown how to embrace and love, the negative side of us. And when you know how to embrace the negative side, it no longer matters what your parents think. Because you step authentically into your power and you know where your wisdom is. You can access your wisdom. You're no longer distracted by extreme thoughts and emotions. You can now bring those thoughts and emotions into a place of manageability. And new conversations start coming out of these young people. It inspires me when I work with people who are very depressed. And within three sessions with them, they're stepping forward and speaking with such wisdom and certainty and clarity and specificity.
I'd like to butt in on the depression, because just before the break, we were talking about Justin Bieber. We listened to a record by Justin and David Guetta, To You. And Justin just recently admitted that he's battling depression. You know, for many people, depression is triggered by a painful experience. It seems to be the opposite for Justin, because his is his struggle to deal with fame.
Yeah, that's presuming that fame is not painful, but of course it has its equal
right.
amount of pain to the game as well. And anything in its extreme is extremely difficult to handle. And fame is very extreme. It's extremely extreme. So, yeah.
And Janetta, they say they're depressed here. But
yes.
Depression is a clinical term. So how do we know they're really depressed?
Okay, well, it's a very good question, because in actual fact, depression is, in my opinion, and some people say, no, I've never felt it, but everybody at one stage gets to an all-time low of some form or another where they just go, wow, I'm so overwhelmed. I just don't know how to move forward. They may not be suicidal, but they're there. Because what happens is when things do work and don't work in balance, you can cope. But the moment that it becomes extreme, the coping skills are missing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when they term it as depression.
And Janetta, at what point should parents take it serious when kids say, young people say, I'm going to kill myself? At what point?
At that point.
At that point.
That point. Bearing in mind also that this is a difficult thing for me to say without it becoming out of balance. But with depression comes a lot of manipulation, because the only way a depressed person can cope is to manipulate everybody. It's the one place they know they can speak their truth, but they only know how to speak their truth by manipulation. So they'll use a lot of psychological triggers and button pushes to try and cope and get everybody to do what they want to do so that they feel okay. So it's a really tricky thing to find that balance. It's one I found very difficult with Jenny, because I knew how serious she was and she used it. It's why she broke the household rules, because she knew Mum won't do anything because she's scared I'm going to kill myself. So it's really important to have a conversation with the parents and the family and the person who's suffering.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important. So everybody knows how to use these powerful skills.
Let's talk about the Ethiopian Airlines tragedy, you know, that has been in the headlines, with the focus now shifting in recent days to the grief and family or family members who cannot be able to locate the remains of their loved ones who died in the crash. What are the first reactions that we have in the face of grief? Is it anger, pain, regret, or a combination of all these emotions?
Yeah, I'm also very glad you've brought this up today, because with huge blessings and thanks to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who wrote The Five Stages of Grief, which was a start. There was nothing before, and it's helped many people. It also is very limiting, because people who are grieving think that if they're not doing it in order to her five steps, then there's something wrong with them. And I've observed that grief comes in cycles, not five steps. and there's cycles of coping and there's cycles of not coping. And initially it's mostly not coping. The world is very, very black. Everything feels black. Everything feels colored black. And then with time, if you haven't got the coping skills, then with time you might get the odd spark of light, and then with the more sparks of light, and then eventually, might take years, might take a lifetime, you find that you've got more light than dark, and the pain is less. And that's how it works. It works in cycles of coping.
What are these coping skills you talk about? Could you take us through them?
Yeah, I can. I'll try and do it in a nutshell. Basically, we're in a world that is very attached to being positive. And the reason why that doesn't work is our whole world works in cycles. And if you study cycles, cycles require equal amount of negative and positive in them. The electricity we're working with here now in this studio requires a balance of negative and positive. If it doesn't, then everything goes haywire. So we understand that the weather cycles, the noise coming out my mouth, all that requires positive and negative charge to create that cycle. And then we're fed that our psyches are different to all the rest of the world. So our thoughts and feelings don't have that apply to it. We must only be positive. Mm-hmm. Now, if you try and be that, there are nearly 5,000 human traits listed in the dictionary, and approximately half are positive and half are negative. And you heard, they're human. They're part of being human. So if you were to imagine that, I'm going to take you through the theater of your mind. Mm-hmm. Imagine that your 2 feet represent your psyche, your conscious consciousness and your unconscious consciousness. Uh-huh. And that in between those 2 feet is the line of balance of thoughts and emotions. And your feet are going from side to side, either side of that balance. And if you try and put both feet on that line, then you flatline. There's no sound, vibration, light, or anything there. So you have to have a wobbly with your thoughts and your feelings on either side of that line. Now then we're fed to be only positive. So now we try and be more on the, let's say the right leg is your positive side. Mm-hmm. So you try and be more on that positive side and you take a step towards the right for each trait. Kind, loving, thoughtful, peaceful, philanthropic or gentle, and let's say you get to 2,500 traits. Can you see how out of balance you are? Now, our wisdom deep down knows we're out of balance. So to help us understand the value of the other side of us, the negative side, and how lovable and loved it is, because the moment you judge your negative side as not being valuable or loved, you're only half loving yourself. Mm-hmm. So it catapults one from one side to the other into a place of, and by the way, on the other side, you're in a place of fantasy and pride. And on the other side, you get catapulted to nightmare and feeling guilty and ashamed. And the more you try and be one, more one side than the other, the more you polarize yourself from center and the more bipolar you become. And that is why so many people are battling with bipolar, because we all have wobblies in our thoughts and emotions. But our lifestyle has produced more extreme wobblies.
I like how you say that, we are attached to positivity. So that when we encounter something, you know, that evokes a negative emotion, we suppress that. We're not supposed, it's like we have a book. We're not supposed to be feeling that.
Yeah, that unwritten book.
Yeah.
Let's talk about.
And so without realizing it, you're leaning too much on one side, you're out of balance.
Yeah.
This week you will be talking about 3 most powerful tools that we can use to live a life filled with appreciation during challenging times, without giving away too much, of course. Give us some context of your presentation.
Well, obviously the very, very foundation of it is what I've just explained. So what I will be giving on Wednesday evening in my talk is some initial tools to start reversing the polarity of extreme thought and feeling that's making everybody who is like that feeling isolated and alone. And everybody at some stage of their life goes there.
Mm. How do you help someone who believes that in a case of suicide of a loved one or a friend, like maybe after an argument or a fallout, how do you encourage someone to stop feeling like they did it, it was their fault?
Okay, well, the very first thing is you can't stop anybody doing anything, because that's rescuing them to rescue yourself. If that makes any mm-hmm, sense.
It does.
So that you feel safe, because you don't feel safe that they don't feel safe. The only way that anything can authentically happen is when a person is ready to say, I need to change, I need to find out. But the moment you've got everybody telling you how you must feel and how you must cope, I call those band-aid cliches, because it's trying to fix the person, and all it does is isolate them more.
We often talk about, you know, quote-unquote closure, but does personal tragedy offer an opportunity to achieve closure, or is it just the pain which is present but is somewhat replaced by other things that occupy us and we get back to the routine of life? So do we ever really get over these things?
No, definitely not, because everything that we experience in life is not forgotten. It's a part of who we are. So I even though I sit in a place of immense grace now, and I'm sitting in my genius and I'm living my life purpose because of my greatest tragedy, I've got the loss of Jenny till the day I die.
Do you encourage families and friends who have undergone tragic circumstances to form support groups to share their stories of recovery from grief?
It's helpful, but it can also be very limiting. I've been many years on closed and secret groups on Facebook, and people get stuck. They get stuck in their stories. The stories start defining them, and then they get stuck in their grief. So it's helpful for a while, but it's not the answer.
Right. You will also be at an event on mental health and company politics. In today's high-pressure corporate, how can companies be attentive to the mental well-being of their employees?
Well, first of all, to be aware of it, because many companies aren't, and many companies also don't realize how much the company politics influence the mental well-being. So it's being able to step forward and really look in new ways with new pairs of ears as to how to handle that. Mm.
Thanks, Janita. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show this morning.
Thank you.
And it's you know, it's very encouraging to see that you turned what was a tragic event into an opportunity to speak to other families and other people.
Well, thank you, Julia. It's been such an honor to be here today, and so lovely to be back in these studios I used to be in when I was a child.
Welcome back home.
Thank you.